is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
The good news is stocks are up this week, and Japan cuts interest rates to negative territory, and the Fed leaves interest rates unchanged, maybe possibly hinting they may not be raising interest rates anytime soon. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Up in Hour 1, Jonathan Krinsky from MKM Partners will be joining us. He's still somewhat bearish. He believes that we could be going through a short-term rally here. You're going to hear what he says about resistance and where we may go even further in the future. Also, Robert Rapier will be joining us. We have oil prices back up over $30. A barrel. He thinks we're going to have an inflection point here, and by mid-year or maybe later, oil prices will be on the rise back up to levels of $40 to $60 a barrel. All of that and Ryan Poplava in the first hour coming up next.
And I'm John Loeffler, and well, I think we're doing this again. I seem to remember this. The Fed met this week, and no surprise, they left interest rates unchanged. At first, the markets rallied, and then as the statement was understood, the markets fell. So what are the markets gleaning from the Fed's ups and downs? And are we back into the same game this year with the Fed and with the markets all knee-jerking and trying to anticipate that? That'll be our subject of conversation today. Coming up on The Big Picture, and above all, what does that mean for people who are trying to invest in what is becoming a rather crazy investment environment? And Ryan Poplava, I have just taken off my seatbelt from the week. Another wild ride in the markets. I wonder if they have economic airbags. We call them EBOs or something like that, you know, that you put on in case of a rough market ride.
It's called a central bank, at least I think that's what they would call themselves.
<That's essential.
laughs> I'm not so sure that it's all that safe, though.
You know, you must admit, if you look at where we are, here we are almost a month into the new year, and it's been nothing but wild since week one. I understand there were a lot of friends at the central banks who tried to assist in rallying the bulls to defend stocks.
Yeah, those airbags.
Yeah, the airbags, right. It's sort of a Pavlovian response, traders buying equities whenever a central bank eases. So would you say this consists of the fundamental catalyst which the market really needs to rally the troops, if you accept the fact that we had short-term technical catalysts, which you talked about last week, if you remember when you were here?
Yeah, and no, definitely this week was front and center, central bank airbag city, essentially. And, you know, the Fed meeting, we all knew, I mentioned it last week, that the central banks from our Federal Reserve as well as the Bank of Japan were going to be important this week, and sure enough, they really were. So we rallied on Tuesday and halfway through the day on Wednesday. And that was because there was a lot of hopes that they would alter their language. You know, we just raised in December. Are you going to recognize some of the weakness that we see here in the markets abroad and also in some of the recent economic numbers? And they did the same thing in September. Interestingly enough, in September, they did the same thing and said, you know, we acknowledge some of the weakness going on abroad, and the market tanked after that, because it was like the Fed essentially certifying that, yes, we're in a weak condition, you should appropriately de-risk. But different situation this week. You know, the consensus hoped the Fed would state they're on pause and that we'll need to see things recover before the next hike, possibly in March, if not later. And so we got that essentially, John, but I honestly don't think it was enough. I have here the FOMC statement. And Bloomberg does a pretty cool thing. It shows the difference in the language. It highlights the areas that have changed. And only half of this whole policy statement on January 27th actually had any kind of highlights in it. The other rest of the half was just fine. And they did give a hat tip to inflation due to energy prices. And what they did is they said, okay, the short term, yes, inflation's going to remain probably low. But their medium term outlook, which was the only thing that they discussed last month, basically stayed the same. same, which they expect to move up to 2%. The other hot tip was to, again, global economic and financial developments and the balance of risks there. Essentially the same thing they did in September, John. But overall, I really don't think it was enough to really help. And we did start to lose a little bit of our ground in the market, and we traded lower on Wednesday after the policy statement. But I think they wanted to keep it neutral. Obviously, any kind of developments that happen in the next 2 months, they're not meeting in February. So they wanted to leave their options, I think, all on the table. Should they feel that things reverse, we continue to see strength in employment, and then they could potentially raise. Interestingly enough, the futures Fed's rates, something I look at regularly now, since we've been talking about the Fed raising interest rates, I think it's moved down to almost, 11% chance in March over the last few days. And that was down from like 26%. And I think the end of the year is dropping too. The end of the year, maybe having a 50 basis point, that would be one hike this year. The probability of that is around 48%.
Interesting. Well, and then we got great earnings from Facebook, and oil rallied its fifth day in the last six on Thursday due to rumors that there was going to be a cut in production from OPEC. So, I mean, any real chances of seeing OPEC agree to a cut right now? Because I think they're trying to make life rough for the fracking crowd.
Yeah, and it's been that way for a full year. Thursday morning, I'm not sure where it came from, but all of the media sources were grabbing the headline and talking about it. Essentially, a Russian energy minister said the Saudis had floated an oil production cut idea and a cut of up to 5% for each country. But later that day, the Wall Street Journal, hey, we get these big rumors, get the journalists to go to town and do their homework. Wall Street Journal said that Saudi Arabia had not made that proposal. And there was a very senior head there who said that it actually was Venezuela and Algeria who had proposed it earlier, not them. And they said they did not ask Russia to cut either. So a senior official at OPEC officially denied these rumors. And then there's Bloomberg. Bloomberg also confirmed later that day there were no plans to cut production or even to talk about one. So, nevertheless, shorts, who I think have been caught by this oversold rally, were kind of left there holding the barrel on Thursday. And then again on Friday, interestingly, oil spiked down midday right around a headline that an Iranian official had said the country would not join any near-term OPEC production cuts. So it's like OPEC coming out of droves, essentially reasserting that, this was just a rumor. And, obviously, I think for OPEC, if we're just talking about them and Iran specifically with their production officially being available, nobody's going to want to lose market share with Iran coming online in that sense and not doing things just under the counter. So as far as I see it, I think nobody wants to lose that market share. And I don't think that we're going to see those production cuts that everyone's kind of talking about. But we do have an oversold rally, and that looks to be continuing.
All right. Well, if you push politics aside here, were there any other fundamental factors which you think affected oil this week that might actually be supporting the oil rally?
Well, yeah, like I said, I think technical is number one. And then I think fundamentally, you've got just a function of the trade being such a one direction with shorts just piling on, just a huge open interest there in energy. And probably those shorts are very nervous with this bounce, and most likely many are covering. So that's creating the squeeze. With the oversold conditions, I think those are still kind of, really playing out. Oil's up six of the last 7 days. You said five of the last six on Thursday. We'll get up Friday. So, last time we had that kind of a streak was in March of last year. So, that was such a long time ago. But there were two catalysts that did kind of touch that segment of the market this week, and stocks were up on Friday. We've seen a huge correlation between oil stocks and stocks. It's almost like, last I looked, was around like 91% between the S&P and West Texas Intermediate. Bonds were up, commodities were up, dollar was up, almost everything was up on Friday. The Baker Hughes rig count showed that another 12 rigs were shut down, so that trend continues, and we have been seeing production has been dropping in the U.S. as a result of all these rigs being shut down and shut in. The Energy Information Administration report on Friday said it dropped 9.37 million barrels per day to 9.318. So just a small tick there, but nonetheless, those were two fundamental factors that affected oil this week. You know, I've been long drawn since Thursday last week on some leveraged ETFs, and I haven't sold yet, but I'm watching overhead resistance, and one of those is near 37. It's where we had some previous support, and then there's also the falling 200-day moving average. So if this is primarily, like I figure, moving off of technicals, that's the area to watch, and you know, I think it'll be tough to get through that in the first attempt.
So Ryan, we don't want to go away without talking about the Bank of Japan this week. Moving rates down to negative territory at negative 0.1%. What is this going to do for the markets in the short and the long term?
Well, I think, you know, like you said earlier in the show, traders have this Pavlovian instinct to buy risk assets. I think central banks have trained us that way since, you know, 2010, I'd say, when David Tepper really identified it in September that year. You know, it's interesting to note the response by the market from this decision in comparison to the one in December. Remember, Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank both added accommodation. They extended their purchase program period and did many other things, but that wasn't a surprise. There was a lot of expectation that they would be doing that. There was a lot built into that release. So, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news. I don't think anybody really expected the Bank of Japan to go negative on Friday. So, you know, we got hints of that last week. I mentioned, you know, on Friday, the markets rallied with the hints from hearing some rumors that the Bank of Japan would be doing something this week. But here we are, and we see the market's actual reaction. The yen just plummeted, and the dollar strengthened on Friday. Everything, most risk assets were up. But essentially, John, this is a short-term event, I think. You know, I don't think it's going to fix the S&P's earnings. The S&P's earnings, which have dropped mainly due to oil, mainly due to manufacturing, which, you know, is export-driven in many cases. You know, it's around, I think, 14% of our economy. And we got those GDP figures out on Friday. It was weak in those two very areas. And I think a strong dollar will continue to hurt our multinational companies and exports, and the kind of move that we saw from Bank of Japan, while we just go on pause, you know, we still have a huge differential there between our central bank policies. So, you know, I'm bullish short term, with the intermediate term looking better as of Friday on the markets overall in equities. But the problems that we've got here haven't been fixed by these moves in the central bank. Whereas I think back in December of 2011, if you recall, we were dealing with a lot of credit issues. Credit was tight. We needed liquidity. We needed an injection. We needed a bazooka, is what we called it. And we did get that with the ECB's long-term refinancing operations. You know, I can remember John just telling my whole office here, guys, this is it. And we completely reversed our allocation as a result of that. Got a lot more bullish. So again, long-term, no, this doesn't fix it. Short term, I think it does drive, you know, some short squeezing here, but we've got a lot of overhead resistance to get through. I do like that I saw at the end of the day on Friday that the Russell 2000, the NASDAQ joined in on those moves in the S&P and the Dow Industrials. I like seeing that because small cap is more risk oriented, more growth oriented, rather than just going defensively to the large caps that are very liquid, you know, a place to rent. I know many people are renting this market right now, if you are long at that point. But, you know, let's see. I think we need some more fundamental catalysts here. I don't think this is it. So you definitely have to continue to watch those technicals to get some idea of where you need to position yourself.
No lack of excitement right here. Of course, we're going to play the will the Fed do it or not game for the rest of the year. You can see this one coming, probably. I don't think they're done with what they did at the end of the year last year. Anything else over the horizon we should be worried about?
Obviously, the economic numbers, we want to continue to really focus on those probably next week, John. And then, you know, it's the first week of the month. Always a very big week on economics. We're going to get manufacturing numbers. You know, the Flash Purchasing Managers Index for the U.S. ticked up, and that's what we want to see. So we're going to look at the ISM numbers next week. I think that'll be really key to follow. That's an area of weakness in the market. Let's see if things have stabilized. I think once we get some of those factors, then I think you can be a lot more comfortable being long this market.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. Thank you.
case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Eric Haddock, the editor and publisher of Inside Track and Weekly Relay, joins us today. And Eric, we spoke with you in 2006, and you had said that you were looking at a top in the market then. Of course, we did see a top about a year later. You saw a massive convergence of cycles taking place, you told us then. And you said the same to us when we spoke to you again last year. In 2014, you saw another massive convergence of sell cycles or cycles coming into play that you felt were really shaping up for a top in the market. And you even spoke of some major crash cycles taking place in 2015 and into 2016 as well. So I want to get your outlook on the market, on oil, on gold. I know that you believe 2016 is going to be what you've referred to as a golden year. So there's a lot of subject and material for us to talk about. But before we do that, would you mind just giving a brief background on cycles, how you use cycles and your technical work to form a lot of your forecasts and your projections for various markets and commodities?
Sure, that does sound like a great place to start, Chris. And thanks for having me back. Cycles, in how I define them, and that's probably the first roadblock to get by, is a lot of people view them differently, and semantics comes into play as to different debates on cycles and their applicability. But I look at them as a kind of a clock or a calendar with the markets and with natural events, with social events, that even if I don't know the exact cause behind them or that's governing them, when you can observe a certain sequence of events going on at a very strict cycle or periodicity, it begins to add credence to that cycle analysis. So I look at it as something that times market movement, market extremes. By that I mean highs or lows of significant caliber. And looking for when you're going to see transitions, sometimes major shifts take place in the market. But I do not use them alone, and I do not use them as an actual trigger mechanism. They are more the backdrop, the foundation for my analysis, but then there's several stages that go beyond that to take the cycle analysis down to a specific expectation in the market, and then even farther to a specific trading strategy, and then ultimately a trigger for that trading strategy and risk points too. So there's a lot that corroborates that and that feeds into it and works with it. I don't recommend anyone trying to trade just off of cycles, but they're a very important starting point and a very important timing point.
Well, the markets didn't take too kindly to this week's FOMC meeting. We've got a little bit of a rally here on a Thursday. Joining us from MKM Partners is Jonathan Krinsky. Jonathan, you think we may have a brief rally going here with possible resistance on the S&P in the 1950-1965 area? Certainly, we haven't been able to get up there since we've been kind of going choppy since the middle of October. So, let's talk about the S&P right now, where you see it, and how long does this rally hold? And if it doesn't hold, where do we go from there?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. So short term, we did think there was a possibility for this relief rally. As you mentioned, 1920, 1950, you know, or maybe we thought you could even get up to 1990, but we can see that it's been very tough to even get above 1900. And I think that just speaks to the ongoing deterioration in the overall market and a lot of the internals. And the fact that the market can't even get that short-term rally despite some of the most oversold conditions we've seen in some time does tell you a lot. And if you think about it, I think one of the ways we like to look at it if you remember the part of the bull market recently from, let's say, late 2012 into early 2015, there were many times when the market got very overbought and you thought it might pull back and it just didn't. It fought off overbought conditions and just kept pushing higher. And it's almost the inverse now. So we have what we would consider as a primary downtrend. So when the market gets oversold, it can resolve that two ways. It can either bounce or it can just move sideways. And, you know, it's starting to almost feel like it's the latter, where it's just working off oversold conditions by moving sideways instead of bouncing.
You know, I want to talk about a dynamic that could possibly play out here. Coming out of the recession and bear market in 2009, we had a lot of events that would happen, and the market would interpret them positively. So if, let's say, GDP weakened in the quarter, or there was some other event, it was interpreted, well, that means the Fed will just keep rates low, and it was positive the market responded. Could we be at risk in going in the opposite direction, Jonathan, where you get what is called a negative feedback loop, whether it's a drop in the price of oil, it's a weak GDP number, which we could get this Friday, and all of a sudden now every event that happens is now interpreted from a negative point of view, kind of like what we saw happen between 2007 and 2009, where every bit of economic news or financial news was a negative event?
Yeah, I think that's certainly a possibility, and maybe we are seeing some of that right now. That's a great point, though. As a technician, we care much more about the reaction to the news than what the news even is. You know, whether it's positive or negative, it's really seeing how the market reacts. And oftentimes when you shift from a bullish to a bearish trend, good news sees an initial pop, but then it's quickly faded, and bad news obviously sees a negative reaction. So that's a good point and something that we are certainly watching going forward here.
A lot of technicians have their own definition of a bear market. You have a chart in a recent piece that you did that is the S&P 500 equal weight index, because the S&P is a market-weighted index, and it looks like it is breaking a trend line in bear market territory. So I think it's, what, down almost 19%? You know, people say 20% is a bear market. What's your view? Bull or bear here?
First of all, the way we would define a bear market is, what is the primary trend? And a good way to gauge that for us is the slope of the 200-day moving average. And if you think about the S&P 500, the cap weight index, that had a rising 200-day moving average for the most part, definitely since 2011. It dipped a little bit in the 2011 correction, but really since then it had been rising. And recently it started to inflect downwards. Now, if you look at some of the secondary indices, like the small cap Russell 2000, the NYSE Composite Index, which is 1,900 components, or even the equal weight S&P 500, which you mentioned, those have seen declining 200-day moving averages for some time now. So they've actually preceded the downturn in the cap-weighted index. And speaking of the equal weight index, you mentioned is down at its lows last week. It got to about 19% from its highs on an intraday basis. You know, so if you are using that 20% definition, there are many indices that have already actually breached that level. And that's just in the U.S. If you go outside of the U.S., it's even worse than that. And a lot of international markets have actually been in below declining 200-day moving averages for a year or two, if not more. So I think, you know, if you look globally, it speaks to the fact that we're in primary downtrends for most global markets. And in the U.S., outside of some of the heavily concentrated cap-weighted indices, we're already starting to see that. And another way to look at it is, if you look at the equal weight S&P 500 relative to the S&P 500 itself, that gives you a ratio. And that ratio has been moving down for many months now. So equal weight stocks are underperforming the cap-weighted index, and that's another sign that the trend is deteriorating.
You know, you have a chart that's rather interesting, and it's called the 2008 Playbook. And in that chart, if you go back to, let's say, November and December of 2007, the market was trending down. And pretty much like what we did last year, it went sideways, and then it finally broke down as we got into the late summer months. Tell me what you see there, and compare that to what you're seeing now and the similarities between these two time periods.
Yeah, so we are starting to see some similarities between now and the 07-08 time period. Now, to be clear, we don't expect anything like we saw in 2008 as far as the magnitude of the decline, which was north of 50% peak to trough from the 07 highs to the 2009 lows. So we don't see anything like that, but it is interesting to note how the market has been acting. 2008 started off with a very weak January, much like we saw this year. and actually put in a temporary bottom the day after Martin Luther King Day. Again, not unlike what we've seen now. And I think what's important to keep in the back of your mind, there's lots of people trying to figure out if the recent low was a major low, a temporary low. You know, I think sentiment did get very bearish, and there's a case that maybe that leads to that relief rally we're talking about. But again, if you think about what happened in 08, we basically traded in a sideways range. Now, it was rather large. It was about 10% from that early January low, like you said, until late June. So, you know, that's certainly a possibility where we basically just work off oversold conditions. You get everyone frustrated. You know, you start to rally. The bulls get excited. You start to sell off. The bears get excited. But really, no progress is made either way. And that went on for 6 months in 2008. So, again, that's just something to think about and keep an open mind. You know, everyone wants resolution. They want to know if that was a low or if we're going to make new lows, and it's possible that we just keep chopping around for a few months.
You know, so much of what has happened in this market over the last couple of years, the market has been focused on what the Fed is going to do, what they said, what is happening with various Fed members. Now we have the Fed in a tightening mode, which is a different dynamic. Could this market outcome change dramatically if, for example, the Fed goes from in a tightening mode and gradually prepares the market to say, you know what, given what we see here, we're just going to sit back and pause because there's enough pressure with the dollar, which a lot of people consider that the equivalent to be in a tightening. Certainly, it's impacted S&P 500 profits. Could that change the dynamic here?
It's certainly possible. But if you look at the action yesterday following the FOMC statement, you know, there was an initial rally, but it gave it all back and then some. So I think everything that the Fed could possibly say is in the market right now. And that's why, you know, again, we prefer to look at what is actually happening in the market as opposed to what anybody is saying about what might happen. So, again, we know that we were in a pretty good bull market for a few years. By our work, the trend has been deteriorating. The primary trend is now down. So, again, any noise that the market may have in the short term based on what the Fed may or may not do, in our view, is just exactly that, noise. So we try to look beyond that and look at what's actually happening below the surface.
Let's move on to the dollar. Obviously, a trend that's impacted profits on S&P 500 and Dow stocks, since many of these companies are international. They get their sales from overseas. The dollar has been in an uptrend. Do you see that trend continuing? And what does it portend, for example, emerging markets and other currencies?
Yeah, so a couple things. First is that the dollar is much stronger than I think people realize when they look at something like the dollar index. The dollar index is very heavily weighted to the euro and the yen, which have been holding up well of late. But if you look at something like the broad trade-weighted dollar, that's actually been making new highs almost on a weekly basis while the dollar index has been flatlining. So I think the dollar on a more broad-based scale is much stronger than people would realize. And I do think that continues. You know, the euro and the yen have been stabilizing, and, you know, that could go on for a little bit longer, but ultimately I think the euro probably does move back lower, which should send the dollar index itself higher. Now, a couple interesting things. People would have thought that the strong dollar would benefit something like small caps because they're more domestically focused, but we know that hasn't been the case. Small caps have been underperforming for many months now. So I think the impact of the dollar is less important than some of the other macro concerns. And we know that small caps in bear markets tend to underperform. So I think that's what you're seeing. As far as emerging markets, a lot of the emerging market currencies have seen just amazing moves to the downside. If you're talking about the Mexican peso, Brazilian real, Russian ruble, South Africa, you can go on and on. They've basically had blowouts to the downside. So that's hurt their markets. I think maybe the setup is for a little bit of a relief rally in their currencies, and maybe that feeds through to their markets. But again, the primary trend for emerging markets has been bearish for a number of years now. And even if we're at some type of low, it's going to take a long time to reverse that trend. So we would say for, you know, very short-term trades, maybe there's some opportunities. But if you're thinking about a structural shift in the trend of emerging markets, that's going to take many months and probably years to reverse.
Let's talk about another trend that could be worrisome and portend something even worse for the market, and that is the widening of credit spreads here. And this is why many have suggested that, for example, the Atlanta Fed has suggested that the Fed tightening has been 300 basis points already with the effect of the dollar and what we've seen take place in the credit markets. You have a Bank of America Merrill Lynch risk index, which keeps heading higher and is close to breaking an upper line resistance line, which means spreads could go higher if that happens.
Yeah, I think one of the things out there that has been getting a lot of talk is that the weakness in high yield has been entirely just contained to the energy sector. And I think it's starting to dissipate a little bit. We're seeing financial CDS spreads widen. Again, it's nothing like we saw in 2008 for most indices and most companies, but they are hitting, in some cases, multi-year highs. A lot of the European banks, their CDS is breaking out. Deutsche Bank in U.S. dollar terms is below the 2009 lows. So I think there is a lot of risk out there, not just tied to the energy sector. We know that the energy sector is at the forefront, but it has started to spread a little bit. And one of the things from our perspective, maybe that we need to see is that Lehman-style moment in the commodity space. We know that CDS on names like Freeport-McMoRan and Glencore and a lot of these energy commodity names have blown out, but we still haven't seen that capitulatory moment. So that's something that we'll probably need to see and we'll be looking for. But yeah, there's many different metrics. And even in the investment grade, we're seeing investment grade spreads start to widen. So that's something that we need to keep an eye on going forward as well.
And finally, I want to talk about financials. Originally, the markets were looking at, well, if the yield curve steepens, the Fed raises rates, that's going to improve the net profit margins at banks. That would be positive for financials. But if you look at the charts of a lot of these big bank stocks and even some of the regionals, the financials are breaking down, which is rather worrisome.
Yeah, you're 100% right. I think there was probably some front running of the Fed's first rate hike because people did think that the curve would steepen. So you've seen a reversal of that because the curve is actually flattened. If you look at the 2-year versus 10-year spread, it's actually at the narrowest, I think, in about 7 or 8 years. So that's unwound. There is also some concern that some of the banks have exposure to energy and that they made bad loans to a lot of these energy companies. So there's some concern about that. And again, we mentioned earlier that the European banks, a lot of them are trading at or near their 2009 lows. So that is a concern. Tactically, you know, perhaps they're getting oversold. I think they're the second worst sector year to date. So maybe you do get a little bit of a relief rally there. But structurally, the relative lines on a lot of these banks have broken to multi-year lows. So that tells us there is a bigger issue here and we'd be more inclined to fade strength as opposed to try to chase it in the financial space.
Finally, let's talk about commodities, in particular gold and oil. I've seen studies showing that there's been almost a 97% correlation between the markets and oil. Day you and I are talking, oil's up 75 cents, up to around $33 a barrel. Stocks have pulled into positive territory. What's your take on oil here and gold?
So yeah, let's start with oil. You know, the volatility has continued to expand. The average intraday range now is something like 6 or 7%, which is the highest it's been in many years. So you have to be careful because today oil's up something like 20 or 22% off the lows. So, you know, if you were able to play that bounce, that's great. But again, the primary and structural trend has been so damaged. You know, it hasn't even touched its 200-day moving average, I think, in over 18 months. That's the longest streak in history. So it's going to take a lot of time to have confidence that the trend has shifted. Now, you can get wild bounces. And as you mentioned, the correlation is extremely high to stocks right now. Our sense is that the correlation probably breaks down from those extremely high levels. Obviously, the question is, which way does it break down? Actually, this morning, we saw a little bit of that where crude was holding much of its gains and stocks were actually selling off. So it was breaking down to the downside. But ultimately, the damage that crude is saying is going to take many months to repair that. So we're not looking for energy or oil to outperform for more than the very short term right now. As far as gold, again, it's like many commodities, it's in a structural downtrend. It's been that way since it peaked in 2011. And very short term, we actually did a little study. Following FOMC meetings, gold has actually traded down the following week about 75% of the time following the second day of the meeting. It's had a nice rally, but again, it's back to its declining 200-day moving average. So risk reward to us sets up to the downside here in gold. Obviously, there's some geopolitical concerns that maybe is keeping a bid to it. But again, ultimately, we would stick with the primary trend. And in this case, that's lower for us.
So, Jonathan, given the fact that this is looking more like a bear market, what would you be doing here? You know, obviously, you want to be defensive, but does there any sector of the market or any asset class look attractive to you here?
Yeah, so we came into the year looking, as you said, on the defensive side. So that means if you're going to be in stocks, you want to be in sectors like utilities, consumer staples, maybe some REITs, and that's continued to work. Again, we would fight the temptation to try to catch the bottom in energy and materials. You know, if you're very short term, there's going to be great opportunities to do that. But if you look at the relative trends sector by sector, the relative trends that are breaking out to new highs are consumer staples, their utilities. And that tells us that that's where you want to stick with. You know, and I think there's no hurry to try to catch the bottom in the beaten down sectors. You know, if in fact energy has bottomed relative to the market, there's going to be plenty of time to play that trade, but we don't think you need to try to call the bottom right here.
So the message here, be defensive. Jonathan, if our listeners like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
Yeah, I mean, the best way would just be on Twitter. That's Jay Krinsky, MKM. I'm also on some of the financial media from time to time.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program today is Rebecca Rotstein. She's an expert in osteoporosis, bone health, and Pilates. Rebecca, let's start with your own personal situation. I guess in your life, you had osteoporosis. How did you arrive at Pilates and develop the programs that you currently lead now?
Well, Jim, it's actually a little bit of a reverse story for me. I was already a Pilates instructor, and then I found out that I had osteoporosis. So it all really starts way back when I was a ballet dancer many years ago. And this is not an uncommon phenomenon that, like many high-level athletes, women who are ballet dancers are predisposed to osteoporosis because of their low weight, perhaps nutrition, their size, etc. So once I had quit and I was already a Pilates instructor, I learned that I had osteoporosis and I was already doing teacher training and knew about osteoporosis, but I really changed my path to specialize in it at that point.
One of the unusual events of 2016 is the close correlation between stocks in the oil markets. The good news, after hitting a record low within a week, oil prices are back over $30 a barrel. Joining me on the program is Robert Rapier. Robert, let's talk about oil prices here. In your estimation, is this just sort of a bear market rally, or are we onto something bigger here?
Well, I mean, it was inevitable that we were going to bounce at some point. I mean, we're seriously undervalued as far as, you know, fundamental valuation of oil goes. So, you know, once you got down to the 20s, with crude oil inventories high and rising, it's hard to say that they couldn't go any lower, but certainly that's not sustainable because all the, everything that goes into correcting the market supply and demand, kicks into higher and higher gear as you get to lower and lower oil prices. So, you know, the further down they go, the longer they stay there, the more they're likely to overshoot to the high side. So I think, people saw some signs that maybe on the horizon here, we've got a balanced market and oil rallied from there. I mean, it rallied a couple of times last year. You know, we ran from 40 to 60 back in the spring and then declined, by year end back down to 30. So, we're not out of the woods yet. We're not out of the woods until it becomes clear that crude oil inventories globally, which are gained a lot last year, are starting to turn the corner. You know, we can see that out on the horizon because production in the U.S. is starting to decline. Demand is forecast to still be strong, although not as strong as last year, but it is forecast to still grow. And the oil that Iran is going to put on the market is not enough to keep up with the U.S. declines and in climbing demand. So I think in the second half of the year, we'll start to see that inflection point and inventory start to come down.
Robert, let's talk about another source of new supply coming online. We know, for example, the rig count is down in the U.S. U.S. production is declining and is expected, as you mentioned, to continue to decline. But let's talk about Iran, because the IEA is estimating that they could bring an additional between 800,000 and 1 million barrels online. What does this do to the supply and demand imbalance in the inventories? While the U.S. is cutting back, you have another supplier increasing production, much like the Saudis did last year.
Right. If you look at the history of Iran's production, they have never added that kind of production over the course of a year. So, you know, I looked at it once, and I think they have tended to add when they're adding, you know, 200,000 to 400,000 barrels a day. We may see them add that over the next year. We could see them add 400,000 barrels a day to the market. But at the same time, the U.S. is going to lose more than that, and global demand is going to grow by another 1 million barrels a day. So I see Iran being psychologically a factor, but not realistically a factor given what else is going on in the market. I just don't think they're going to impact it as much as people think.
Now, let's talk about what's going on in the U.S. We've seen the rig count drop. We've seen production coming down, and it's at least the reports I've read. We got a peak last April around 9.6 million barrels, and we're expected to get down to 8.6 million barrels, a reduction of nearly a million barrels. Let's talk about what's going on in the industry. When we got down to $26 a barrel, I mean, even a lot of the big guys, the Chevrons, the Exxons, the Shells, can't make money when you get down to levels that low. So those prices, even though we may hit them, or who knows, we could drop down there again in the futures market. But how sustainable is that? Because at some point, you don't want to be selling something that's at a loss. And I'll get to the debt issue in just a moment. But what is a sustainable rate? What is the number overall in terms of oil prices that, let's say, U.S. producers or international Western companies need to get?
Yeah, so I just got back from the Permian Basin last night. I was there for most of the week, and we drove around all over Texas and New Mexico, and we saw very few drilling rigs, and we saw most of the wells were not pumping. So, you know, activity there is down a lot, but it's actually better in the Permian than it is in a lot of the other places. The Bakken has been even more devastated. Talked to a lot of people, a lot of oil services people, a lot of oil people, and they were talking about how bad business has been hurt there. But of course, they've seen this before, and they talk about the 80s and when this happened in the 80s and how they came back from that. It's going to simply be a matter of, so everything is correcting right now. They're going to, you know, tighten up their belts, or people are making cost cuts as deep as they can. But you ask about the price. I think the price that it needs to be is probably, to meet current global demand, is probably about $60. Now, that, and I talk about this sometimes in terms of peak oil. I think a peak oil as a function of price. The world has passed peak $20 oil. There is not enough oil in the world that's economical to produce at $20 to meet global demand. That doesn't mean that oil can never get to $20 again, because people can lose money for a period of time and they can overproduce for a period of time. But for the long term, for the sustainable production of to meet world demand, I think you're going to need something like $60. I think 3 years ago that price was probably $80, but the marginal barrels were costing that much money. But the shale guys have gotten a lot more efficient. They figured out how to use the optimal number of stages and how much sand to use. And so their cost per barrel for these wells has gone down significantly. So I think that number is about $60. And I think as they continue to squeeze cost out of these wells, you're going to also see global demand come up a little bit. So I don't see it coming down a lot off of $60. You know, maybe you see 50, but if you look back at the quarterly reports last year, at the $50-$60 range, a lot of companies like EOG Resources, for instance, were generating positive free cash flow. At the same time, some of them were reporting negative income because they were taking impairments. They don't have as many reserves on the books when oil's at $50 as it was at $100. So they have to write down some of those proved reserves, but their cash flow is still positive, and that's important. As long as their cash flow is positive, you're not worried about them declaring bankruptcy.
Robert, let's talk about what this means longer term, because you have company after company. I don't care if it's Shell, if it's Chevron. The major companies are laying off employees. I think I read the figure last year, over 200,000 jobs lost in the energy sector. So when the energy sector starts to cut CapEx and slash it, as many of the majors are doing now. In fact, a lot of the major companies have said, you know, we're going to protect that dividend, and where it's coming out of the upstream operations of the company, which means they're cutting back on projects, they're cutting back on exploration. And sooner or later, you know, you're selling a barrel of oil today. You got to replace that barrel of oil. So what does this mean down the road? Because energy is kind of a unique industry. It's not like manufacturing where you can flip a switch on and all of a sudden you're producing more widgets when you need them.
Right. And, you know, I ask people sometimes, I say, why do you think oil is $30 a barrel right now? It's $30 a barrel because it hung around at $100 a barrel for so long. And that enabled so many people to go out and get money and to drill. And everybody was drilling for oil, and you had very marginal prospects being drilled. And that set up an oversupply situation. And so right now, as oil is at $30, the longer it stays here, the more capital expenditure cuts, the more layoffs, the more we're setting up a slingshot back to the high side. So, you know, I tell investors, you know, from my perspective, I'm investing when I think we're below a sustainable price. Now, that doesn't mean we can't go lower. We can go lower. But it means that over the longer term, I think I'm going to do okay, because I think we're going to rise back and we're going to be sort of more fundamentally based. You know, fundamentally, I think oil needs to be about $60 to meet global demand. So at current prices, I'm an investor. I'm moving money in. And I know I've got to be patient, because it may be a year or 2 years before we sling back to the high side. But we will. We always do. The only thing that would keep us from doing that is if we had alternatives to come in and replace oil. And this is the argument I get from people sometimes. They say, look at coal. Coal's not going to recover. And I say, coal has a lot of replacements. I mean, you have a lot of scalable equivalent replacements for coal, like natural gas, like nuclear power, like all kinds of renewables can displace coal. You do not have that situation with oil. There is nothing out there that is both scalable and economical that can replace oil. And until that happens, you don't have to worry about oil prices falling and staying down, because there's no demand for it. In fact, demand continues to grow for oil. It grows and grows and grows. It's grown, I think, 18 of the past 20 years, and it will have, when the numbers come in, it will have grown again in 2015, and it will grow again in 2016. Electric cars are not coming on fast enough, and they're coming from too small of a base to have any impact on global oil demand anytime in the next probably at least a decade, if not longer.
Well, let's talk about what's going on in the industry. And this raises the question, at prices where they are today, there are a lot of people during the boom period when we were selling at $100 a barrel, a lot of smaller companies went out and borrowed money. A lot of that debt is expensive. Some of that debt is coming due. And a lot of these companies have to keep continuing to produce, not necessarily because they want to sell oil at this price, but because they have to sell oil in order to meet their debt payments. There was a report recently on Bloomberg that as many as 400 companies could be going under because they simply can't sustain this.
Yeah, and you're going to see a lot more of that this year. I think last year there was a hope that we'd have a recovery in the near future. I think right now with oil at 30 and inventory still high, I think reality is sinking in. I think you're going to see a lot more bankruptcies this year than we saw last year, as it becomes clear that the recovery, we're not going to see a recovery back to $70 or $80, you know, in the next 2 or 3 years. And that's what some of these highly leveraged companies need. And so I think you will see the bankruptcies accelerate this year for some of these highly leveraged players.
Yeah, and there was another issue, too. Some of these players were fortunate enough that they hedged their production. So even though the price of energy fell down to 40, fell down to 30 in the 20s, some of these companies had hedges on at much higher prices. A lot of those hedges are coming due. So we could see even a bigger squeeze on these companies, not only from rising interest rates,
and the reluctance of banks to, for example, extend credit. So what does that mean? If a number of these companies start to go under, doesn't that present opportunities for those companies let's say, are flush with cash or have cash or strong balance sheets? Because if the banks have to take over these companies, bankers are not oil men. They don't want to sit on oil assets. They want to get rid of them.
Right. And I agree completely. Those with strong balance sheets. And it's going to be interesting when fourth quarter results start to come in. And Chevron just released fourth quarter results, and I was studying those this morning. Those that have strong balance sheets are going to be in a position to scoop up some companies for pennies on the dollar here. And I expect to see that from, some ExxonMobil's and some EOG Resources has had a strong balance sheet. I'm going to be interested to see where they end up the year and what their annual report looks like. That the annual report is going to be very telling this year. I think we're going to see massive write-downs on reserves from last year. And I'm going to be interested to see who takes the biggest write-downs and who was able to maybe not. I don't know that anybody is going to generate positive free cash flow for the fourth quarter, but who survived the fourth quarter? Because I don't think it's going to get much worse than that. And those that survived the fourth quarter without getting, financially digging a much deeper hole, I think those are the ones that you can bet on for the recovery.
Let's talk about the big companies. A lot of the companies, you take the Exxons, the Chevrons, one of the saving graces that we've seen with the integrated oil companies, they may be losing some money on the upstream operations, but the downstream operations on refining oil, they've been making money. Now, a lot of these big companies, from Chevron to Occidental Petroleum, a lot of them have said, you know what, we will maintain that dividend. If we have to cut CapEx, which is where the savings are coming from, what is your faith in the strength of those dividends? Because some of these dividends, quite honestly, well, I don't care if you're looking at Exxon, Chevron, Occidental Petroleum, they're looking at yields that are almost as good as junk bonds.
Yeah, and I think in some cases they're making mistakes because in some cases they're selling off assets. And you're an oil company, you're a good oil company. Is it better to sell off assets to pay a dividend, or would it be better to cut that dividend and hang on to those assets? And, I think some of them, ConocoPhillips in particular has dug in and they've said, we're going to do whatever we have to. And that includes selling off assets to fund that dividend. And I don't think that's a good idea. I agree with you. The downstream has been the saving grace. Downstream performed very well in the energy sector last year. But as a result of the crude oil export ban, you've seen the premium of Brent over WTI, you've seen that disappear. And actually WTI, several times lately has traded higher than Brent. And that's going to hurt these refiners. And I've looked at Chevron's earnings that they just released, and their downstream earnings, fourth quarter 2015 versus fourth quarter 2014, were down 50%. And you're going to see that across a lot of the refiners. You're going to start to see their margins eroded as a result of the end of the crude oil export ban. They don't have that captive market necessarily anymore. Now, some of them, like Valero, they're still in a pretty good position. They will still make money, but it's not going to be the good times that it was, over the last 5 years, where they had a captive market and, high international prices. They could export their fuel.
Robert, how long does this thing take to play out? I mean, if we take a look at the peak in oil prices late 2014, oil prices have been on a decline since then. And so we're almost, 18 months that we've seen prices decline. We've seen the rig count drop dramatically. But as we were talking earlier, some of these smaller companies have to keep producing because they have to meet their debt payments. How long do you think this plays out before it finally corrects, balances itself, and then we get the slingshot in the opposite direction?
Well, if it plays out naturally, if OPEC doesn't do anything, if they keep producing as much as they can, if they don't cut to accommodate Iran's oil, it could be, earliest second half of this year to 2017 that we could start to recover. But OPEC, of course, if they came to the table and said, okay, we've inflicted enough pain, we think we've caused enough damage to U.S. shale to set them back a few years, I did some numbers recently. In fact, I wrote an article for Forbes called OPEC's $1 trillion miscalculation, and it's gotten 170,000 views. So people really, really like the article. But I just laid the math out. I said OPEC has cost themselves and will cost themselves through this year $1 trillion because of the decision they made to try to defend market share. And will they ever make that up? I don't know that they'll ever make it up. But, you know, they're dug in now. Saudi Arabia, they made a decision, which I think will go down in history as one of the worst decisions that they ever made. And it's hurting. You know, 9 out of 13 OPEC members want them to reverse that decision. And Russia is now, you know, apparently talking to OPEC about possibly coordinating cuts. If they did that, if they could get together and Saudi could instill discipline in OPEC, oil prices could recover very quickly. The flip side of that is the reason they cut in the first place is they didn't want to prop up the shale oil producers, and that would happen. Now, the calculus from OPEC's perspective has to be, how long can that go on? How long can shale production expand? And I'm sure that was the discussion they had in 2014 where they made this decision. Said, how much longer can this go? Personally, I think we would have peaked on shale oil production within the next 5 years, maybe 7 years. OPEC might have had to have cut production a couple more times, and they might have lost some market share. Global demand was going to keep rising, and once shale production peaked, OPEC could have gotten their market share back. So instead, they said, no, we're gonna squeeze out the high-cost producers. Well, there was a risk to that, and the risk is that the high-cost producers cut expenses, and they get a lot more efficient, and it takes longer to squeeze them out, and that was the miscalculation. I think OPEC expected the whole shale industry to fold quickly, and I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding that, you know, there are thousands of producers out there, and they're all making decisions in their best interest, and they're varying amounts of leverage, and so you don't see this just dramatic cut of 50% because it's not a monolithic organization. It's so many different fragmented producers making those decisions. So you just see a much slower decline, I think, than they expected. At the time they made this decision, oil prices were still at $75. And I think what they believed was, yes, we may dip to 65 or so, but at 75, some of these shale oil producers are already having trouble. So once we say, hey, we're going to go out and we're going to defend market share, prices may drop into the 60s, and then there's going to be all these bankruptcies, and then we'll be back in the catbird seat, and we'll have our market share back. And it didn't work out that way at all for them.
So when we take a look at this, there's oil rallied on the fact that Saudis were talking to the Russians. So if you take the three largest producers, the U.S., Russia, and Saudi Arabia, within OPEC, I mean, who's going to cut? It would have to come from the Saudis. It would have to come from the Russians, because you've got Venezuela and a lot of these smaller OPEC producers, with the exception of Iran and Iraq, are hurting in terms of what the governments need in terms of revenue to keep things running. So would the cuts have to come from the Saudis and the Russians primarily?
Yeah, they would. I mean, Saudi produces the majority of OPEC's oil, or not the majority, but the largest share. They produce like 30% of OPEC's oil. So the cuts would have to come from Saudi. But if they instituted, you know, I calculated that if they took a 5.5% across the board production cut, they could have taken all the oversupply off the market. And they could have arrested the price drop, and we'd be sitting probably at $85 a barrel today instead of $30 a barrel. They would have lost a little market share, but you know, their market share is still quite high. They still have 40% market share. They would have given up about 1% market share to make that cut. But you know, we'd be talking about a very, very different thing today as far as the oil markets go. You know, the oil prices are where they are today because, well, number one, we had $100 oil for so long, and number two, Saudi put fuel on the fire by saying, hey, we're going to defend market share, and they dumped more barrels on an already oversupplied market.
You know, as we look at this, they've got to be rethinking that. They've gone through $100 billion of their reserves defending their peg. There's talk about taking Saudi Aramco public because of the cash. So they got to be thinking, you know, if we cut back a million barrels a day of production, half a million barrels. Let's say we get the Russians to throw in a half because they're hurting in recession. This goes on for another year. Russia's economy could collapse. So maybe if the two get together between them, they could cut a million barrels a day. Yeah, we might see a ramp up here with the shale producers, but I think you're right. Even with Iran coming on, they could stabilize the market.
Yeah, the black swans in the market that swing prices very quickly seem to always happen to the high side. And if you saw an announcement that Russia is going to cooperate with OPEC and they're going to across the board take, you know, a million barrels off the market, you'd very quickly see a recovery in oil prices. The question is whether they've got the discipline to do it. You know, I always try to think of things in terms of Saudi shoes and OPEC shoes and what it is, all the information that they have, the decision they have to make. And I was shocked coming out of the November 2014 meeting, the decision that they made then. Because I was thinking, if I'm making that decision, I make a very different decision in that case. And then when they came out of that meeting, you know, oil prices had declined from 100 to 75, and the decline accelerated then. And then they've had two subsequent meetings where they came out and said, nope, this looks good. We're going to keep overproducing. And each time, oil prices have made another leg down. So, you know, they have to be kicking themselves. And you know, a lot of people like Venezuela are saying to Saudi, you see what you did? You're killing us. So there's a lot of pressure on Saudi to blink here. But if they do, it says, you know, we were wrong. And I see them saying things out in the media like, well, you see what's going on, the rig counts in the U.S., we're winning. Our strategy is working. Well, you've got $1 trillion to make up now by the end of this year. You'll be having to make up $1 trillion. And I don't know when you ever managed to do that.
So given where we see oil prices right now, they're recovering, and who knows, we can get an inventory report that can sink prices again and we could go lower. But as you mentioned, if you're looking out and maybe with the possibility of prices recovering back to normal here by the end of the year, if you had to invest money, where would you be putting money in the sector right now?
It depends on your risk tolerance, really. I mean, a lot of the midstreams, the MLPs, are deeply oversold, and they're still generating, you know, decent cash flow. A lot of them are still covering their distributions just fine. So, you know, that sector has corrected down with the price of oil, and it shouldn't have. It shouldn't have corrected as much as it did. So, you know, if you're sort of a conservative income investor, there are all kinds of midstream companies that are looking pretty good. If you have a little more risk tolerance and a little bit more time horizon here, I'd be shifting money into the oil producers. And, you know, you can do that through an ETF, or you can buy a mutual fund full of oil producers, or you can start, you know, putting it in some of the oil producers that are still generating positive cash flow. That would be I would look to the balance sheets, because you don't want to get into something that's going to go bankrupt if we have another 6 months of low prices here. So I would kind of avoid the refiners. I wouldn't be buying refiners now. I think some of them will still do fine, but I think that, you know, the good times are gone for them now. They lobbied hard against the end of the crude oil export ban, and there was a reason they lobbied hard against it. It will cost them money. Those margins they were getting are going to shift now to the upstream producers. But refiners, their stock prices are still going up. You know, they're still being priced as if the good times are going to continue. And while I think that they're not, you know, in dire shape, I don't think the outlook is quite the same as it was for them.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as always, we appreciate you coming on the program. If our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Yeah, so I write in several places. Lately, I've started writing a column for Forbes. I give them 5 columns a month, and that's where a lot of my newest stuff will be. So under Forbes Energy section, there'll be a section for me and my columns. I write for Energy Trends Insider. I write a column there every week or so. And then I write at least two columns a week for Investing Daily, one on MLPs and one just on the general energy sector. And then I've got a subscription column there called The Energy Strategist, where it's 2 times a month. We run model portfolios and we make buy and sell recommendations.
Well, as President Ronald Reagan used to say when the press would get on his case about something, now there you go again. Yes, I guess we could say that about the Fed this week. Well, actually, they didn't go again. At least they're saying they're not going to. They raised interest rates at the end of last year, but now the speculation's back on for the rest of the year as to whether or not they're going to raise interest rates sometime during the year. So I guess in real truth, yep, there we go again. The Fed said they were going to leave interest rates unchanged for now. The markets rallied, and then the markets fell as the statement was really understood. So what does that mean as we go forward in 2016, especially in the area of investing? We'll discuss all of that in the upcoming Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.